studying it, and teaching it. First of all, I want to go to what the... This is what I'm planning on doing over however many lessons it takes. It's probably going to take me a year because I don't get to teach that often. Number one, what are the cultural values of Palestine in biblical times? This is the fourth one that I'm teaching on number one here. Number two, what kind of a person was Jesus? How was he regarded by those who came in contact with him? And a lot of number two is going to depend on what we discover in number one. Number three, understanding Jesus and other New Testament writers' teaching in light of the culture. Once we understand the cultural values of the time, we can understand why Jesus was considered such a radical for his time, which we've really lost sight of, I think, in the church. Number four, how has Jesus' ideas and other values from the Bible influenced Western civilization and American culture? And then how have those ideas influenced American political thought? These are all things that I've sort of been interested in for a long time, and I'm putting them all together, and it's going to take as long as it takes to get through it. So we're still working on number one. So let's talk about cultural values. As Christians, we believe that the Bible is the inspired Word of God. There's many things we do to try to understand the Bible better. It's really important to all of us that we have a good Bible translation. It's important to us that we understand the history of the time. A lot of us feel the need to go to the Holy Land, so we get a feel for the geography. We get a feel for what the place is like when Jesus was there and the people who surrounded him. But there's one thing that is missing most of the time in the teaching of the Bible, and those are the cultural values. What were the values of the people who lived in that time? How did they regard Jesus? How did they see the world? And we talked the first couple of Sundays I did this, we talked a lot about honor shame. We spent two Sundays talking about that. Gloria, you said you found something in Proverbs that had to do with honor shame. Do you remember the verse?
I don't know where it is. I tried to find it. But it's something to do with better is, or more coveted is a good name than great riches or something like that. And it dawned on me that, like, in our day and age, like, say, if I came in late a bunch of times to work and I goofed things up and I made a mess of things, I can always just get another job in another state, move clear there, be a brand new person, and reinvent myself. But in biblical times, they were stuck. And if somebody, you know, ruined their good name, there was no other village they could go to.
That's right.
Everything was embedded. So they had to defend their good name. So it was
interesting. Yeah. Okay, I want to ask the class a question, and I want individuals to raise your hand. I'm not going to put you on the spot. I just want to know, how do you, if I asked you, John, who are you? Tell me about yourself. Identify yourself to me. What do you like? Go ahead. I'm just putting John on the spot, not everybody else. Yeah.
I'll get you for this. Yeah. Well, first I'd probably define who I am spiritually.
Okay.
Since that's most important, then I'd get to physical things, like maybe my age. I know I look 21, but what I do for a living.
Okay. What do you do for a living?
I'm a contract negotiator for NASA, JPL.
Describe your personality. What characteristics are?
I tend to be very analytical. I mean, I'm outgoing, not an egghead kind of thing, but I'm very gregarious, but I'm also very analytical. So I tend to use both sides of my brain.
Okay. What else?
Well, the first thing I probably is, as I said, the spiritual, about my relationship with Christ,
mm-hmm.
and what that means. To me, and that I love apologetics, and I've described basically what that is about, Tim Bethencourt.
Gloria, you're married to him. How would you describe him?
I know what you're driving at. You're driving at, in biblical times, he would have started off with, I am John, the son of so-and-so. So he would have started with the family he came from. And nowhere in this did you hear anything about the family he came from.
That's right. You are right. I want to read something out of here. I'm picking this up in the middle of the paragraph, but you'll get the idea. If anything in life is unpredictable, it is not the individual human being. We're talking about the collective personality. Rather, unpredictability derives from something or someone beyond the control of the predictable and unchanging human beings we might know. So there is no need to look inside the individual human being, either oneself or any other. In other words, it would make no cultural sense at all to ascribe anything to personal and uniquely individual psychological motives or introspectively generated reasons and motivations. Another way to say this is that the collectivistic personality makes sense out of other people by means of sociological thinking, by means of reasons typical to the group. By our standards, such sociological thinking would be based on extremely poor sampling techniques. We would call such perceptions stereotypes. Identity in that time came from how you related to the outside world. The idea of describing yourself as kind, decent, unkind, whatever those characteristics are, those were not things, that is not the way people thought about themselves. Now let me give you some biblical examples. Consider the following statements. Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. That's in Titus. Judeans have no dealings with Samaritans. That's in John. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killing the prophets and stoning those who are sent to you. Matthew and Luke. Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. Mark, that's in Mark. Now, we would never say that to someone now. We don't identify someone with the city that they came from or the area that they came from. We see, yeah, yeah. Who are you? You were born in Burbank.
You're one of those.
I mean, it sounds... Yeah.
It sounds...
That's right. But I don't know about those people in Sierra Madre, I'll tell you. And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? That's in Matthew. Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, who and are not his sisters here with us? That's in Mark. So everything, you see how this is working? People are identified by stuff outside of themselves, by the group that they're in. Note how such statements derive their understanding of some person on the basis of family, village, or city in which the individuals are embedded. Okay? How did Paul identify himself?
What's that book?
This book? He identified himself as a Pharisee. He identified himself as from the tribe of Benjamin, a Jew, a persecutor of Christians. All of those are externals.
Roman citizen.
Right. This is why, a Roman citizen, this is why the lineages were so important. Because your identity didn't come from inside of you, who you are as an individual. How do people think of you? Well, one of the ways they think of you is, who was your father? Who was your grandfather? How far back did you go? That's why those lineages, if you could say, I am a descendant of David, automatically, you're a pretty good guy. It has nothing to do with you. It has to do with where you came from. What's that?
You could be a louse, but be a descendant of David.
That's right. That's right. But they wouldn't even think like that. You automatically were worthy of some honor and worthy of respect if you could say that you came from David. If your identity comes from what others think of you, how are you going to behave? What are you going to do? In these cultures, where your identity comes from is, if it's not from inside, it's what other people think of you. It's what the group thinks of you. Ted?
Well, you'll try to fit into whatever that outline is of you. You know, if you're from Galilee, you act like a Galilean person. If you're a Pharisee, well, gee, what do the Pharisees do?
That's right.
If you'd like to, or if your dad was a great football player, well, gee, I got to be a great football player. How would you like to be Hugh Ross's son?
That would be a tough one. That would be. So what you're going to try to do is not blaze your own trail, find your own way, figure it out for yourself. What you're going to do is try as hard as you can. You're going to work as hard as you can to gain other people's acceptance, which means what? You're going to try to fit in. Now, if you're trying to fit in, and you're trying to fit in, and everybody else is trying to fit in, then where is the identity in that? You can see how there's not an individual identity in the way that we think about it. The identity was found in family, in whatever group that you are in. You did not think of yourself primarily as an individual. Your primary identity was, who am I in the group that I am in? I'm a father, I'm a husband, this is my family, this is my identity. That's why people in the Bible who were widows and orphans and people who were by themselves, it wasn't that it was just hard for them, it was that they were identity-less. They were not embedded with another person. They were not embedded into a family. And therefore, they were disregarded by the society at large. Is this making sense?
Yeah. Isn't all that same thing true today? People feel identity based on the group they are in, whether that's using the same criteria or a different one?
Yeah, I want to say that a lot of these values that I'm talking about are here in this culture. It's just that here it's so complex. We can say, I'm going to go to school, I'm going to get an education, I'm going to make a lot of money, and I'm going to provide for my family, and I'm going to make that happen myself. And we see that as a good, strong American value. And it is. It's fine. But no one would have thought that way in those times. Okay, now, providing for your family is part of that collective mentality. But imagine that that's the only way that you thought about things. That idea of doing it on your own, doing it for yourself, making a name for yourself, I'm going to go do the right thing no matter what. Those ideas are gone. They don't exist. The only thing you're thinking of is in terms of family and group and how do I fit in and how do I meet other people's expectations. And if anybody slanders me, if anybody says anything bad about me, I got to work really, really hard to fix that because that's my identity. Oh, my gosh, they're slandering me. In this culture, we can just say, just let them say what they want. You know, sticks and stones may break my bones. Well, you couldn't have said that in that culture. Beverly?
I'm working on understanding the concept of belonging and how you belong. And in that culture, like today often, you belong by how people accepted you and how they received you. It was what they did that allowed you to belong.
That's right.
But I think how Jesus teaches it now is that you are to create joy and belonging around you. And it's no longer their acceptance.
Right, and I want to stress that as I go on in this talk later in a half hour or so, I am going to start introducing my own ideas about collectivism versus individualism. But right now, all I'm trying to do is describe to you how it was. There were advantages, there were disadvantages. I'm not trying to say it was good or bad in relation to how we think about it. I'm just saying that if you don't understand this value, there's a lot of things in the Bible that you're not going to be able to understand when you read them. Al?
Yeah, I think a modern-day example is Japan. The Japanese, you know, they're more cohesive as a group.
Mm-hmm.
They're not so individualistic like we are in the West. And you can see that in the great disaster that they just had, how they coalesce to help each other.
Well, Dave?
Yeah, it's interesting. What you're describing, obviously, is I've always had a difficult time understanding the attraction and why people stay in gangs. and what you're describing directly applies to the gang. That's their mentality, you know.
Yeah.
At the point where they'll, you know, murder and kill. He said something about my mother, you know. And
that's right.
And to me, obviously, it was always like, this is bonkers, you know. This is another universe. Why would you want to kill somebody, you know? And I've had conversations with people, you know, my work, obviously, you know, that mentality. I couldn't understand it, you know. It was like, you know, it's like, you know, get a grip on reality. But what you're describing describes exactly.
That's
what
right.
Things do to maintain people within their groups and to maintain that behavior and why they do what they do.
See, this is this idea of operating collectively without a sense, an exterior sense of right and wrong, is basic. This is sort of how humanity works without God's influence. Read the Old Testament. Read Genesis and Exodus before the law was given. People were already in clans. They were already doing things in terms of paying attention to how things worked for them. They were a group and they were fighting another group. There wasn't anything in their mind about right and wrong. And that's where understanding Jesus and other New Testament writers' teaching in light of the culture, okay? The natural human way to do things is to bond together in groups like this collective personality, irregardless, not even thinking about any external right or wrong. But Jesus came along, and we're going to do this later, but Jesus came along and gave us this incredibly, insanely radical idea that their idea that there is right and wrong independent of what you're doing. Just looking out for your group isn't enough. What if your group is doing something that's wrong? Beverly?
My cousin married a Japanese man in Japan, into an old family, and she loved how they got along. And the beauty of the group culture. But then she began to run into the little idiosyncrasies. So her husband didn't like to smoke. But when he got in the group, he couldn't ever say, no, thank you, I don't smoke, because that was wrong and insulting. And so instead, he'd go, have a cough. And so she found that they began to lie and do things that were not okay with her culture, or, you know, her norms. And yet, that was the cost of peace in a group culture.
Right. Ted.
I often think of team athletics anywhere from sandlot baseball to pro football. There's strong identity with your team.
Yeah.
Or think of the 101st Airborne, the Marine Corps. Or as you pointed out, the values can be very negative if you happen to belong to a group of gangbangers.
Sure.
But that group association can be very powerful. People lay down their lives for those group associations.
You know,
do good things or horrible things, either way.
The team, you know, if you're a sports fan or even understand team sports, it's a great analogy, because in team sports, you're not worried about too much about right or wrong. You're not worried about internal motivation. You're either going to win or you're going to lose. Any one person is not as important as the team. If the person gets injured, there's a backup, that person comes in, the team wins or the team loses. So imagine thinking like that all the time, never turning that kind of thinking off. Gloria?
There was some movie that our son had us watch, I don't know, about feudal Japan or something like that, China. And one thing that struck me was that there were the serfs, or poor people, and then there were the samurai, profound people. And I noticed that you could never change.
Oh, that's right. Yes. That's a great movie. Your goal in first century Palestine as a wife of John would have been to fit in absolutely as best as you could into whatever social class John was a member of.
Don't rock the boat.
You would not strive to be to move up in class, because that's something that's inherited. That would be a dishonorable thing to do. So you would be the best wife, fit in how people expected you to fit in as best you could, being John's wife.
Isn't that true of India with the caste?
Yes, very much so. Let me read this. I read this last time, but it's really powerful. In contemporary American culture, we consider an individual's psychological makeup to be the key to understanding who he or she might be. We see each individual as bounded and unique. This sort of individualism has been and is now extremely rare in world cultures, and is almost certainly absent from the New Testament. In the ancient Mediterranean world, such a view of the individual did not exist. There, every person was understood to be embedded in another person and had his or her identity only in relation to those who formed this fundamental group. For most people, this was the family, and it meant that individuals neither acted nor thought of themselves as persons independent of the family group. Yeah, Jackie?
The family is consists of one man and one woman and their children. Is that right?
Yeah, although it could be extended if you lived long enough to have grandchildren. It would include, if I was the man of the patriarch of the family, it would include me. It would include my wife. It would include maybe any brothers and sisters that I had that somehow didn't marry. It would include my sons and their wives, because any daughters that I had would have moved in with their husband's family. Well, what family is she embedded with? Who does she belong to? Yeah, that once that person dies, then that's right, because she's embedded in the husband. Yeah. Well, if she has children, the children, especially the son will protect her. That's a really interesting point, because in our culture, here's another thing that the Bible teaches that is different than what we naturally do. Who is, other than our relationship with God, who is the most important person in our life, our spouse? But in this culture, the most important people, the most important connections were a mother and son, because this idea that the wife becomes connected to her husband in the way that we think about it didn't exist in those times. The wife was never completely accepted by the husband's family. She was there to procreate. She was there to do things in service to the family. But the person who would protect the mother the most was the son. The son stood up for the mother. That's why it was so important to have sons. If all you had was daughters, you were gonna feel really alone.
You know what just dawned on me is Jesus really did a radical departure from that. When he was on the cross, he looked and he said to John, "Behold thy mother," and he said to his mother, "Behold thy son." Instead of, because he had younger brothers, half brothers, and so that was a radical departure.
Yes, that's right. And this is so exciting to me. This is where I want to go with number three. We have really lost touch with how radical Jesus' teachings were. We see them now as the norm. We see them, well, of course, this is the way it ought to be. But compared to the culture that he was in, he was a complete nut job. I mean, I don't mean that in any bad way. I mean it, that's the way the people would have seen him. That's how strongly their reaction would have been to him.
Yeah, the same point, but with a slightly different emphasis on Jesus' words about who is my mother, who is my brothers and sisters, the people who follow God. And that one's even more than just his mother. They're talking about brothers. And
yeah, and I'm going to finish. That's good, because I'm going to finish with that verse. Sure.
He can serve. On a lighter note, but for those who love Star Trek, the Borg.
Yes,
case of the collective thinking.
Yeah, they didn't even have an individual consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Getting back to that, I think Jesus, in this time, was a radical, because he went around preaching about the kingdom of God, and yet the people around him, the Jews, the other Jews, had a God, Yahweh, in their temple. And what Jesus also went there to
to worship at the temple. So he was a total Jew. So I always get the impression, why, while he was preaching, did he ever go up to the temple and, you know, tell the temple guard, look, you remember me, I was here 9 years ago or 10 when I was here, you know, discussing the law with the high priest. And he said, let me in, I want to go see my dad. He's up there in the Holy of Holies, and talk to him. Why did they do that? I was his father, and he was right there. So but he was, I think he was a total radical in that sense. Although we don't know much about his 33 years before that, what happened.
Right.
Would be good, be nice if somebody came up with some...
Well, I think we don't know much about it because I think he spent 30 years of his life being in the culture and being a part of the culture.
Yeah, that's right.
So that he, for 3 years, he, yeah, that's right. He, what he said would carry some legitimacy. All right, I've got some of these charts that I want to, I did these last time because I think these things are really fascinating. Okay. All right, I want to go to number 10. I don't know why I can't do this. Okay, I've got about 20 of these. Some of the, they're just really fascinating when you put the two values next to each other. U.S. value. Generally, a person is not expected to and will not share less tangible resources with others, often not even with nuclear family. For example, time to watch a weekend football game. Mediterranean value. Persons are ready to share less tangible resources with group members, for example, giving up some interesting activity for group ends. So you wouldn't even be thinking about watching a football game by yourself because it wouldn't have a value if it wasn't part of a group thing that you were doing. Excuse me here. I can't make this work. I tried that. This one is good. Wait a minute. It's not switching. Who knows how to do these PowerPoints? I don't know. Man.
Okay, so you're not running the show. That's why.
What?
You're not running
the show. The show is. I won't touch.
Why don't you run the show?
Did it do something?
I want to go to. So how do I do it?
Where do you want to go?
I want to go to 12. Okay. Is that where? All right, that's where I'm at.
You have to start slides.
But if I want to go to the next one, how do I do it? I thought I had this figured out.
You have it on... Which mode are you using?
Well, while you figure that out, I'm going to read this one. I love this one. U.S. value. Persons are expected to form their own opinions on a range of issues, especially politics, religion, and you it just went away.
Okay. So this is not displaying what this is.
Yes. So make it happen. Persons are...
Do you want presenter mode or...
I just want to be able to push the button and make it change. All right. Don't change what's on there because I'm going to read it. Thanks. Persons are expected to form their own opinions on a range of issues, especially politics, religion, and sex. Expert opinions accepted only in law and health, and this only for oneself and nuclear family. We would look at that and we would say, of course, how else do you think about things? You make up your own mind, you make up your own decisions about things. But in the Mediterranean value would be people are willing to adopt the opinions of others, especially those considered of high esteem in a wider group.
Even if that made no sense.
No, because there's no right and wrong. This guy, this is your leader, that's his job. Let him lead. you're a peasant, you take care of your wife and your family and you do peasant things and you're an honorable peasant, but your involvement in the greater world, that's up to the guy who's leading. Why do you think, look at this. Now you can understand why it's so hard to introduce the idea of democracy, the idea of one person, one vote, into some world cultures. Because they're not even thinking in terms of the idea that my opinion has any weight when it comes to how the government should run.
Yeah, you got to consider, too, the educational level of those people. You know, they were pretty ignorant. And to have a democracy, you have to have a fairly educated...
Well, there's a lot of ignorant people in this country who think they can run things. At least in those cultures, they know they're ignorant and they know they can't run anything. All right, so what button do I push, Rich?
Just click or push the next button.
All right, thank you. Hey! Unless others are involved, U.S. value, unless others are involved in one's goals, there is little concern about one's impression on others. True? We don't care a whole... Ruth, what do you want to say?
Yeah, if in a family, you're saying that they can't go up the ladder.
Right. Because he was the son, he was from a family of leaders. He came from a group. Right. Or somehow he was militarily strong and was able to take over. Unless others are involved in one's goal, there is little concern about one's impression on others. Embarrassment affects the individual and at times the nuclear family, but not any group at large. In other words, generally speaking, if someone did something wrong in this church, most of us are not going to feel dishonored by what somebody else did in the church as a group. In that culture, absolutely, the whole church would be dishonored by the bad behavior of one person.
One bad apple doesn't ruin the barrel, is an American idea.
That's right. Mediterranean value. Persons are constantly concerned about self-presentation and loss of face, since these reflect on the group and one's position in the group. Val.
I disagree.
Okay.
Okay, if there's a public figure, let's say a very famous televangelist, you know, somebody that does something embarrassing, it embarrasses the whole church.
Well,
I mean, all the believers are now shamed because of what somebody did publicly.
I think as Christians in this culture, we have a little bit more of an individualistic way of thinking than the culture at large. If Richard Dawkins, as a scientist, as a secular scientist, did some horrible moral thing wrong, would all scientists feel dishonored as a group? Probably not. If someone does something wrong in the church, yes, we do feel it. But we don't feel it as much as we would have if we were part of that culture. It's not that we don't feel these values, we experience them. It's that they're to a much less degree.
But the way you worded this, embarrassment affects the individual, but not any group at large, that's pretty cut and dry.
Well, these statements are really super generalized. Generally speaking, things that we do embarrass us less in this culture, embarrass others less in this culture than they would if we were in the Mediterranean culture. Ted?
If you take a look at the Islamic point of view, it seems that nothing an Islamic person does can bring the condemnation of the entire Islamic community.
Well,
viewpoint toward it. Whereas if a Christian were to do something dishonorable, we throw stones at the guy and say, man, that guy, Jimmy Swagger and say, gee, that was not a good thing.
My understanding of that is that most people who are Muslims do not identify themselves with Islam primarily. Their first point of identity is with whatever group they're in, the tribe they're in and the nation they're in. That's why, I mean, I've heard this said, The Muslim world will never unite. You know, they say they want a worldwide Muslim movement, but when it comes right down to it, they never can, because Libya thinks differently than Tunisia, who thinks differently than Saudi Arabia, and they hate each other. The Sunnis hate the Shias. Oh, yeah.
Person who does something wrong, the whole community, regardless of to us it's wrong or not, probably whatever they do is right, it's right, to us it's wrong. But if they do wrong to their eyes, the whole community will attack them. You know, and this is something I would like to add something. In the Muslim culture or Middle Eastern culture, if someone insults you, he doesn't just insult you as a person, he's insulting your family, your tribe, or everything. So this is why we need to understand the culture, and this is why we, you know, we cannot understand why it was that. We don't understand why they're doing things, because we don't understand the way they think. And I think you're right. They think as a group. You cannot go and attack one person only, because that person has family, has the community behind him, and depends who's attacking him. Like, for example, if another tribe attacks a certain tribe, two tribes are going to be fighting each other. But if another foreigner or another country is attacking them, then the both tribes unite against you. So that's the mentality of the Middle East.
Mara?
Is that why if somebody does something like goes against Islam or something, then they have to worry about their families being in danger also?
Definitely. I mean, if, for example, one of the things that the Muslims let you cannot become a Christian.
Right.
If you become a Christian, then the community can have the right to go and kill you.
Right.
This is what we see in Iraq.
Right.
The many Christians, we lost from 3-4 million people to 500,000 so far. Many of them were attacked and stabbed because, and many of the Muslims who become a Christian, they cannot declare that in the media. Because if they do, the community has the right to go and kill you.
Because you're bringing dishonor to the group, which is your primary identity.
And this is why everybody, whatever Israel does to the Palestinians, in Libya and Somalia, everybody goes against them because they consider this as a foreigner attacking their group, which is Islamic.
To further that just a bit more, is that consistent then with what Ross was saying about the different countries or the different groups like the Shiites and the Sunni and the Iraqis versus Tunisians, that they will stand behind each other or they will have separate values based on the culture they were in?
Currently what we see in these Shiites fighting the Sunni, but trust me, it's, you know, like what you also see in Libya, the United States is trying to help certain groups, and trust me, the minute they put the soldier on the ground, the Shiites and the Sunnis will fight against that.
I want to read one more thing here. We're going back to that idea that you're not thinking in terms of an internal motivation. You're not thinking in terms of psychology. Let me read this, and then I want to give you some examples. In our culture, we tend to consider a person's psychological makeup, his or her personality development from infancy on, as well as his or her individuality and uniqueness, as perhaps the most important elements in understanding and explaining human behavior, both our own and that of others. Yet if you carefully read the New Testament writings or any other writing from the same period, you will find an almost total absence of such information. One obvious reason for this state of affairs is that the people described in the New Testament, as well as those who described them, were not interested in or concerned about psychological or personality information, because it was internal. Otherwise, we should find as much of such information in those writings as we might in a modern biography, novel, or newspaper. Since this kind of information is lacking, you might conclude that the first century Mediterranean person did not share or comprehend our idea of an individual at all, and I believe you would be right. And I want to.
Jesus pointed out, which I'm sure you'll get to, the importance of individual thinking. He says, even if you think and lust after a woman in your mind, you've committed adultery with her in your heart. So, I mean, that's he goes to the extreme of the inside.
That's right. And that's how, again, here's how radical his teaching was compared to the culture. Everything, almost all of the writing in the New Testament and the Bible is externally descriptive. There's little, very little about motivation. And when you do come across words about feeling and motivation, take it really seriously, because you don't see it very often. And if they put it in, it means it was extreme. Let me give you some examples. Here's the from John 4, the woman at the well. Now, see if you can find anything in this description that is what we would consider motivational or about feelings or about reasons why it was done. Okay? A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Then the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you the living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you go to get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock?" Jesus answered and said to her, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw." Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." And the woman answered and said, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You have well said, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband, in that you spoke truly." You get what I'm saying? Jesus said, the woman said. Jesus said, the woman said. Jesus said, the woman said. It's all external. There's nothing about, why don't you have a husband? Why are you doing this? Woman says, doesn't say, how do you know these things? Who, what? There's nothing about feelings or motivation in the way we would think of the internals of who we are. I always used to find this really frustrating. I would read the Bible and it's like, I want to dig deeper. What's underneath all of this?
Yeah, that's one of my objections to the Bible, too. We don't know anything about Jesus' love life. He was a Jew and 33 years old. He's healthy. And he was, most Jews at that time would have married and had kids. But he is running around the neighborhood preaching. What was his love life? I mean, we have women all around him, and they're just trying to pick this girl up in the well. What's there that amazes me is that who was there to hear him? Who was there to hear this conversation with him?
Well, yeah, him and the woman in the well. There may have been other people.
Yeah.
There may have been other people there.
They didn't write it down. They didn't know he was. It was going to be written in the Bible. In the Bible, 500 years.
No, but that doesn't mean we can't trust it. There was a lot of work done to put all that together at those times. Right.
Yes. Group.
That's right. Another characteristic of people with these values is there's absolutely no privacy, and gossip is rampant.
Well, nobody was writing it down. It doesn't say there was another apostle down there taking it down.
Jesus could have told his disciples that.
Hmm?
Jesus could have told his disciples that.
I've got about 15 minutes to wrap up, and I want to cut down on the questions, because I got two points I want to make, and I'm not going to get to it if I take too many questions. So let me go with this.
You're in control.
Thank you.
You're running the show.
I thought I was. Matthew 9:9. This one always fascinated me. As Jesus passed on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me." So he arose and followed him. Why? We don't know anything about his motivations. Did he know him previously? What was going on there? How did he feel about it? Jesus said, "Follow me." Matthew got up and followed him. That's all we need to know. That's right. Now, this is from Mark. Then he came to Bethsaida, and he brought with him a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and he said, I see men like trees walking. Then he put his hands on his eyes again and made him look up. And he was restored and saw everyone clearly. Then he sent him away to his house, saying, neither go into the town nor tell anyone in the town. Now, how would you feel if you were the guy had been blind for however long he was blind? All of a sudden he can see. How did he feel about it? See, these are all questions we ask. What was going on? What did he think about it? How did he feel? How did Jesus feel healing him? They weren't concerned with those questions. They weren't concerned, so they didn't talk about it. I want to give a good example of a little conversation I had with someone, a good friend of mine, not too long ago. We were discussing, and I don't remember the event, but it was an event in the news where an individual who was raised in a Christian, morally upright family, who, the child of these people, when he grew up, did some horrible moral failure. And I was talking to my friend about how this could happen. And my natural take on it was, well, the person has free will. It doesn't really matter what culture, you know, how good their parents were. Parents could be wonderful parents. The child grows up, has free will. He can do something horrible if he wants. Well, my friend, who comes from a culture where it's much more collectivistic, said, no. If the parents raised the child right, the child would not misbehave. And we went back and forth for about 10 minutes, and I realized this is a great example of what I'm talking about. My natural assumption is, being an American, Western, growing up with more individualistic values, is the responsibility is the individual. They can come from a wonderful family and turn out lousy. They can come from a horrible family and turn out good. Most of that is the individual. My friend was saying, no, most of it is the family. Well, the truth is it's both, of course, but it was an interesting example. I thought about it afterwards. This is the natural bias that I have. That was the natural bias that my friend had. So the responsibility for morality and deviance is more on the social body than on the individual in these cultures. Okay, now, I had several people tell me last time, get to the bottom line before you end this time. So, given that this is a value in Mediterranean times, that the value that we have, the very super hyper individualistic value that we have in these times, is actually really rare in human history. It's even rare right now. Most people on the planet right now think more in terms of a collectivistic personality. What can we learn from this as hyper individuals? What does the Bible say about how we should be thinking about ourselves, about God, our relationship with God, and about each other? 1 Corinthians 12. I don't want to read this whole thing, but it's the passage where God talks about, well, I'll read it. For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and have all been made to drink into one Spirit. For in fact, the body is not one member, but many. So, we are supposed to be thinking of ourselves, not so individualistically. We're supposed to be thinking of ourselves as a collective body, at least as far as Christians.
Yeah, Bob, you read that, it's interesting. I came away complete opposite of that, because if you study church history, that verse is talking about the no difference between the Greek, the Jew, the slave, or whatever, is what was so attractive to the first century Romans,
right.
Greeks, it is because obviously Jesus was so radical and taught about this individual faith, that you come directly to God, his relationship with God, that you don't have to go through the Roman or the Greek system,
right.
To try and get to God, and that was so appealing to the first century because it was so edited, so radical, obviously, that, that every person, no matter where they were in that social structure, could be put on the same level in front of a holy, righteous God and get forgiveness.
Right.
And that's why Christianity swept through the Middle East, you know, through the Roman Empire, was because of this teaching that there is no difference, you know. In that culture, obviously, women were not even fully human, obviously, in that regard, obviously. And yet, Jesus came back there and said, no, you know, women are on the same par as a man, no matter whether you're a king or whether you're the poorest peasant, you know, you can stand before God righteous, equal. And that just swept along with the Holy Spirit.
Well, but it's a balance. There are ways in which we are supposed to think of ourselves as individuals. We are individually responsible to God. There are ways in which we are supposed to think of ourselves more corporately. We are members of one body, and each of those members have different functions. And our main identity is not in our individual selves. It's in our relation to God. And, you know, this is another one of those places where Paul, in this case, is saying he is bucking the culture. He's saying all of these external things that we all pay attention to, being a Jew, being a Greek, being a slave, being free. He doesn't say it here, but Jesus said man or woman. None of that matters. That doesn't matter. What matters is something deeper. Let me give you another example. Revelation 21, "Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people. God Himself will be them and be their God." How collective can you get? We as a corporate group, the church, are going to be the bride of Christ. Matthew 23, "Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven, and do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Matthew 12, well, I'm going to get to that one in a minute. Ephesians 2, "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God." Interesting. John 17, "I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they all may be one, as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. And the glory which you gave me, I have given them, that they may be one just as we are one." So the persons of the Trinity are collective. We, as a church, are collective with God. Now, I want to read this verse in Matthew 12. I want to close with this. "For whoever does the will of my Father, which is in heaven, the same is my brother and sister and mother." Ruth?
You do something bad, any external behavior directly, you just made your father look bad. And same goes spiritually. You want to, as a person who is identified in Christ as a Christian, if you do something bad externally, you make God look bad, and He's your father.
Yes.
So either you make Him look good or make Him look bad by what you do externally, as well as internally, but it's what people see. And you want to make God have this good reputation.
That is an excellent point, and it's sort of where I'm going. I was going to go in a different direction. But think about the people to whom the Bible was directly written, the people who lived in first century Palestine at the time of Jesus. For them to hear the idea that God is our Father comes with that all of these cultural values. And what Ruth is saying is right. If we did something that was sinful, selfish, that dishonored ourselves and our family, we're also dishonoring God. And that is a value that we are missing right now. And I was going to go to it in the same... hang on, Mara. I was going to go to it here. "For whoever does the will of my Father, which is in heaven, the same as my brother and sister and mother." Now, how would the people who that was written to, how would they have heard that? We hear that as we are sort of symbolically brothers and sisters with each other, and we're supposed to defer to each other and treat each other kindly, and sort of a vague notion that we're supposed to be closer to each other than we normally would with someone who isn't a believer. But they would have heard identity. Our identity is in our brothers and sisters in Christ. Our identity is in our relationship with Jesus. It would have been a much stronger to say that all believers are our brothers and sisters. It's a much stronger statement than the way we think about it. Mara?
The woman at the well. Look at how many lessons are in that one thing. So if this woman's sitting there telling about her feelings and all, you know, feelings change, you know? So I kind of like that, that you go and you can pull. That's why it's timeless. You can pull all the lessons you have to learn at that time when you're reading that, because you could read it 5 years from now. I mean, something else to you. So, I don't know. I like the facts, ma'am.
Good. So I think what I want to leave you with is my really strong impression in going through this, that our identity, our true identity, if you really analyzed it, who are we as Christians? Who is each one of us? Our identity can only be found in relationship. It's in relationship to God primarily, and it's in relationship to other believers and other people that we care about. That is really the only identity you have. The fact that I'm a builder, the fact that I'm 54, the fact that I'm single, the fact that whatever, those facts, they do not make me who I am. Who I am, my only identity that I truly have is that I am created and loved by God. And look at some of the things that we do as Christians. We're asked to pray for each other. Well, prayer is inherently a collective thing. By praying, we are supposed to be saying, if I'm praying for you, I am saying that what's going on with you is as important as what's going on with me. And it's so important that I'm willing to take some of my precious time to consider you over myself. Love. You go through the love chapter in the New Testament. Love, obviously, is by definition, collective and relational. So that's what I came away with, is I think we're supposed to temper our individualism that we have in this culture. We definitely go too far with it. You can go too far the other way, but we are brothers and sisters in Christ in the sense that we really are supposed to look out for each other. We really are family, and what we do with each other, to each other, should matter as much as what happens to us. Jim?
One of the differences between us and them is that we choose, as individuals, we choose what group we identify with.
Right.
Not just because we were born.
It's much more complex in this culture. Yeah, that's true. Okay, Mara.
I would like you, the coordinator here, that maybe this gentleman could teach a lesson sometime about whatever we were talking about.
You've been volunteered.
would you be willing to?
If people can understand me, I haven't.
The collective body is asking you to. All right, thank you, everybody.
Close to prayer.
Yes. Lord God, there's so much in your word that we can glean about who you are and our relationship to you, and we thank you for another way to look at it. We ask that this lesson this morning really teaches us about what's important and how being close to you, caring for each other, caring for ourselves is really the ultimate, true, honorable value. And the rest of it is just not very important. Thank you so much for your love and patience and long-suffering with each of us, and bless us each as we go on our way. In Jesus' name, amen. Thanks, Rich.